Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Carroll, a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University. He's a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. Previously, he served as Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974, and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named Best Columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. His books include House of War, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and The War That Came Between Us, Practicing Catholic, Constantine's Sword, which was made into an award-winning documentary, and Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the ancient city that ignited the modern world. His latest column in the Boston Globe is Pope's Resignation Was His Most Important Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Carroll.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to be with you.
And your column in today's Boston Globe suggesting that the Pope's resignation was his most important act, that's predicated upon the notion that, I take it, that he has shattered a kind of, what you call it, a convention. Is this radical in terms of the long and somewhat frozen history of the Catholic Church?
Well, it's deeply radical, actually. It's curious and ironic, Ian, that the conservative pope should end his pontificate with a profoundly radical act. It's 1,000 years that the papacy has been the linchpin of Catholic claims to transcendent status, set apart from the world. You could even say set above it. The pope is the vicar of Christ. There's a kind of transcendent quality to the pope's not only status, but personality even. You see it in the modern world, as I said in the column today, by the way he dresses, the way he talks, the way he lives apart. And the claim that the Pope, the Church itself, has a divine right to its special status, almost above the human condition, has been embodied in, of course, not that popes are exempt from the human condition, but in a way, the claim that they are. And part of that has been seen in the way when a man is elected to the papacy, it's for life. 600 years ago, you've read in the press, a pope resigned. That's not true. The Pope Gregory XII, who left the pontificate almost 600 years ago, was fired by a church council. Popes, of course, in those days were assassinated and were mafia-type characters in power struggles. But there was always this mystical quality about the papacy. Pope Benedict XVI has spent his time both as a pope and as a cardinal defending the divine right of the Church, and the divine right of the Church embodied in this otherworldly character of the papacy, by not just resigning from his office, but preparing to live, in effect, as the retired pope on the grounds of the Vatican. He wrenches the Holy See itself into the mundane realm of a kind of normal life. He's like a former college president. He's like a retired company CEO. He's like an ex leader of a country.
You mean like Pope Emeritus?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, he's become one of us, which I regard as great news. You see, I see this as a tremendous facing of the reality of the authentic character of the Church, which is not above. It's not apart. The Church is in the world. Vatican II made that explicit. The Church is not otherworldly. The Church is a community of human beings, all of whom are bound by the requirements and limits of the human condition. And the sooner we rid ourselves of this fantasy that the Church is a superhuman institution, the healthier we will be. The sex abuse crisis was abetted by this mysticism. Priests were assumed to be better than other people, and that's part of why the abusing priests got away with what they got away with, and then part of why the bishops would rather cover up the abuse than deal with it. So it's all of a piece, and Pope Benedict, despite himself, lives in the, let's call it the postmodern world, has been breathing the air of the world we all live in now. And this option he has chosen shows that despite his ideological commitment to a worldview rooted in the Middle Ages, he too lives in the 21st century. This is a good day for the Catholic Church. We all wish the Pope well and hope that his infirmities are as benign as possible. But we also owe him a debt of gratitude. Perhaps despite himself, he's brought the Church another step forward into the 21st century.
Again, I'm speaking with James Carroll, distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University, a former priest who became a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer. And he is also a columnist at the Boston Globe. His latest column is Pope's Resignation Was His Most Important Act. So since in the modern era, the papacy had to join the temporal world and lost its sort of monarchical powers, and you mentioned all of the earlier history of the Machiavelli and mafia-type tactics of the this, although I must say they still have a seat on the United Nations. Gary Wills has a piece in the New York Times.
Yes, I saw it. It's always just bracing and good to hear from Gary Wills.
Well, because he describes the modern papacy as having given up all of their power and trappings of an early kind of monarchy. Now they are a moral monarchy. And I think what you've just mentioned in terms of the abuse and all the scandal, of course, once you set yourself on that pedestal, you are surely setting yourself up for an impossible level
of course,
of piety.
Sure. And when, yeah, and you know, when the Pope claims to be infallible in teaching of faith and morals, as the phrase has it, then failures to live up to essential, basic moral standards scream out louder than ever. We saw that during World War II with the wartime Pope Pius XII, who, like so many other world leaders, was passive and silent in the face of the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews. And we've seen it in the way in which the popes over the last decades have reinforced really unjust attitudes about the equality of women, and more recently about the rights of gay people. These are scandalous violations of what contemporary world recognizes as basic norms of good order and justice. So the papacy, the Catholic Church itself, are human institutions like all others, and that's not a scandal for me, a Catholic. I am a convinced and a practicing Catholic. No, it's the essence of what the good news of Jesus Christ is, which is that we all stand in need of forgiveness, and the good news is that the forgiveness is on offer. It's available to all people, Christians and Catholics included, and God knows we need it.
Well, what Gary Wills is suggesting here is, though, that the laity throughout history has been more true to the gospel than the hierarchy of the church, and that the claims of priests and popes to be the sole conduits of grace is a remnant of the era of the papal monarchy, and that, in effect, he's saying we don't need priests.
Well, it's a complicated... I certainly take the point he's making, his direct criticism of the record of the hierarchy, the church hierarchy, because the popes and bishops for more than 1,000 years were political figures who were subject to the same temptations and pressures of political power whenever. And it was only a little over a century ago, that the papacy itself lost its political power, and the kingdom, the vast swath of Italy that was under the rule of the Pope, taken away by Italian revolutionaries in the 1860s into 1870, and it was then that absolute power was claimed in the spiritual realm for the Pope. Most people don't know that the doctrine of papal infallibility was only formally promulgated by the First Vatican Council in 1870, and that was an absolute claim to spiritual power to replace the poor pope who had lost all of his temporal power, all but Vatican City, you know, which is smaller than Central Park in New York. So this is a human history, Ian, and it's only because the church has fooled itself into thinking it was above the human condition that it can come as something of a surprise. Not surprising history at all.
Well, in your column, James Carroll, in the Boston Globe, Pope's resignation was his most important act. You mentioned that Pope Benedict was decidedly ambivalent about Vatican II. You mentioned a minute ago about Pope Pius XII not standing up to the Nazis. One of the things I find extraordinary about both Cardinal Ratzinger, the current pope, and the previous pope was how, for example, the current pope has been desperately trying to beatify Pope Pius XII, which has upset a lot of Jewish theologians who have hoped for some...
It's true. There's a move on in the Vatican, has been for a good while now, to raise Pius XII, the wartime pope, to sainthood. I'm not saying that Pius XII was a war criminal, but it would be absurd to declare him as a saint. And why are they doing that? They're not doing that, actually, because Pius XII was an exemplary moral model. It's hard to argue that. They're doing that as a way of protecting the power of the papacy. So the more you criticize a pope, the more those who rally to the power of the papacy want to defend him. And it's really that simple. Pope Benedict's resignation from the office of the pontificate is related to that because it effectively demystifies the power of the pope. And that's what needs to happen. And that's what Vatican II began to try to do in the early 1960s, demystifying, bringing down to earth, making it more of the earth and of the world, making it reckoning with it as a human institution. And it seems like the popes and bishops are the last to know, because the whole world gets it now, how fallible, even in its morality, the Catholic Church is. Because if that doesn't come clear from the priest abuse scandal, with thousands and thousands of children abused, and then perhaps, who knows, thousands of priests, the abusers, and then every presiding bishop, wherever this has come up, protecting the abuser instead of the abused. Most recently, of course, Cardinal Mahoney in Los Angeles being reckoned with as a bishop who failed to protect the children. Why were they doing that? It isn't that they were callous or wicked men. It was that they thought their duty was to protect the reputation of the church above all. And that's why Benedict has conducted himself also by failing to reckon fully and properly with this crisis. And protecting the church in those ways is protecting this mystical fantasy of an institution that's above human beings. And that's what they were desperate to do. And that has failed. It's over. The priestly sex abuse scandal did that. And in a very different way now, in a completely different moral order, but in a similar consequence, that's the effect of Pope Benedict's resignation from the papacy. The church is a human institution, which is not its flaw. That's really its glory, because God comes to human beings.
But this particular pope, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, he took it upon himself to control, if you will, all the jurisdiction over clerical abuse to fall under his jurisdiction. And he stated that the cases of this kind are subject to pontifical secret. So he's in many ways more responsible than anybody else. And my understanding was that he did try to get the previous pope to get his head around it, and apparently he couldn't. At least that's the story. Maybe it's whitewashing the current pope a little. But there's no question that he has played what I think is, in all fairness, is an extremely unhelpful role.
Yes, it's true. Ratzinger was the man behind the throne throughout the pontificate of John Paul II. And that order you refer to, he issued in 2001, an order claiming, an order to all bishops in the world that cases of priests abusing minors were to be referred to him, which was interpreted widely, whatever his intention, as an order not to involve civil authorities. That took place some months before this scandal broke into the open with the Boston Globe's reporting of cardinal laws enabling of a priest abuser here in Boston, Father John Gagan. So it's very clear that Ratzinger had put in place the very structures of protection that led to the protecting of the abusers. As Pope, he has tried more forcefully and more directly to reckon with all of this, and he certainly authentically, sincerely expressed tremendous misery and regret and remorse for the crimes of the church, of the priests, and the cover-up. But it's been too little and too late, and I wouldn't be surprised if the terrible demoralizing that's been a result of all this isn't a factor in his coming to the end of the rope, the end of his rope, as he has here with this resignation.
But what explains the fact that this pope was so unsuccessful in his seven-year tenure? Perhaps he knew he wasn't going to have a long tenure, but he was somewhat feared in his previous role as the kind of enforcer.
He was. It's astonishing, Ian. It's a very surprising story. He was an extremely powerful man. He cut down people. People he didn't agree with, he silenced. He removed the Catholic credentials of a great theologian like Hans Küng in Switzerland, Germany. He excommunicated a theologian in Asia, Tisza Belisaria, only to restore him later. He was feared, a man of tremendous power. He was the Pope's Dick Cheney, in a way. And then when he became Pope himself, he just made one misstep after another, continually having to apologize for mistakes he made. Early in his pontificate, he condemned Islam by citing a medieval source that slandered the religion of Muhammad in a totally
gratuitous way. Really.
Yes, and he had to apologize for it. Right. And the next thing you know, he's apologizing regularly. It became a kind of astonishment, the ineptitude with which he exercised power as pope. I'm afraid his papacy is going to be regarded as a significant disappointment, even failure. The church, the moral authority of the church is in shambles. Whoever his successor is going to confront a huge, huge problem. There's no restoring the moral authority of the church, of course, without vast and deep reforms, admitting women to the priesthood and admitting women to full and equal power throughout the church, getting over the sexual neurosis of Catholic Puritanism and the way in which this obsessive focus on sexual morality defines the hierarchy, getting over this craziness about contraception. One of the most important health issues facing the planet is the overpopulation of the planet Earth and the rights of women to control their own reproduction. So there's just huge issues, and I believe the time is right for major change. And we've seen an example of it before. If I can lift up one signal of the kind of change we're hoping for in the Catholic Church, we need a Mikhail Gorbachev. Somebody who will come into a crumbling and demoralized and, yes, let's face it, tyrannical institution and preside over not just its reform, but the dismantling of the deeply corrupt structures of power. And Gorbachev showed us how to do it. And if it can be done in the Soviet Union, it can be done in the Catholic Church.
Well, just in closing, James Carroll, of course, this outgoing pope was extremely hostile to the ordination of women, to a degree that was almost irrational. And so many of the cardinals are going to be choosing his successor were chosen by both Ratzinger when he was in charge of the doctrine and by the former pope, and they're all incredibly conservative. So what gives you hope that we can that the Catholic Church can find a Gorbachev amongst, what, the 117 cardinals that...
Well, don't forget where Gorbachev came from. I mean, believe me, you never would have predicted that a reforming, open-minded, and effectively, in the end, liberal ruler would have come out of the Politburo of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev, one of his predecessors was Yuri Andropov, who was the head of the KGB, a sinister figure if ever there was one. For Gorbachev to come out of that that collection of nefarious characters was, I mean, it was almost enough to make you believe in miracles, for goodness sake. And it wasn't that Gorbachev wanted to become Gorbachev. History required it of him. History requires equivalent openness to change in the Catholic Church today. The page has turned, and the medieval, monarchical, mystical Catholic Church is dead, and it's up to the cardinals now who choose the next pope, and then the next pope. It's up to them to realize it. And my own confidence isn't in the particular men whom the conservative establishment has selected to do this. My own confidence is in the power of history to impose itself on people who are able to actually read the signs of the times. And the signs of the times are screaming at us by now.
Well, James Carroll, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian. I wish you well.
I wish you well, too. Again, I've been speaking with James Carroll, who's a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University. He's a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer. And he previously served as Catholic chaplain at Boston University and left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named best columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. His books include House of War, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us, Practicing Catholic, Constantine's Sword, which was made into an award-winning documentary, and Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the ancient city that ignited the modern world. His latest column at the Boston Globe is Pope's Resignation Was His Most Important Act. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by half.